Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, not really. Not really, insofar as we are not in the hills and hollers of almost level West Bicod, Virginia. I am, however, Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, and it's Thursday night. Thorn in the side Thursday, to be precise. But we're not in, no. We are, in fact, on Capitol Hill in the headquarters of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, the AKE campaign here in Washington, D.C. We are pounding the pavement, knocking on doors, and doing as best we can to get the AKE Act passed. We like to call what we do here Conversation Radio, and we certainly all do appreciate your participation in it. Thorn in the Side Thursday, the 6th day of June 2013. Of course, the 6th of June being a momentous day of its sort. Now, the 6th of day is momentous because it is the anniversary of D-Day. D standing for nothing in particular, except for the fact that was the military designation for the day that we would launch Operation Overlord, the invasion of the European mainland via a crossing of the English Channel. It was ultimately successful, though brutally costly. And very few people know that there was no certainty, no sure thing. You know, in history, we look back on events as they transpired, and since they did happen to transpire, we tend to think of them as having been almost foreordained. But it wasn't. It wasn't at all. And in fact, in Dwight Eisenhower's papers, there was discovered an alternate announcement that he was prepared to deliver in case D-Day failed. It was as follows. Our landings have failed, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone. Interesting. Interesting. Notice how he says, if any blame attaches. Because writing this in advance of the Normandy invasion, he didn't know exactly what could possibly go wrong that would cause a disaster, that would cause a withdrawal, a retreat. But he did acknowledge the possibility of it. So, just a moment to remember this momentous day in history, June 6th, 1944. Irish Dave noting, golly, June 6th, 1969 was the day I had to report for induction. I always assumed the D was for Dave. Sorry, Dave, but no. So just a little something to ponder on this here day. A lot of stuff to go into this evening. My apologies first and foremost for my absence of last night. But as I noted on the Tuesday night show, we had a whole bunch of, well, we had meetings all day long, and actually they went on into the night. Some of it had to do with strategy. Some of it had to do with, well, it almost all had to do with strategy. And it was a very tiring day, but by and large, I've been quite excited at the prospect of getting back to the air tonight. You know, just to give you an idea of what happens when people work together to advance the AIC Act, and, you know, you can learn about it by going to aicact.org, aicheact.org. For instance, our dear friend Jude has been working on contacting her member of the House of Representatives, and lo and behold, that has resulted in the scheduling of a meeting. And we will be going to talk to members of her representative's staff. Dr. John has reached out to a member in upstate New York, and we have made contact there. Some of our friends in Wisconsin have reached out to their representatives, and we have set up meetings there. This is all ever so much more effective when they know that the folks back in the home district who knock on doors and put signs in yards and give money and things like that, well, that the AIC Act matters to them. So never doubt for an instant the impact that you have when you reach out to your member of the House of Representatives or to your senators, because we are, after all, trying to get some traction in the Senate as well. If you happen to live in Tennessee, for instance, and you wanted to contact Lamar Alexander and Bob Corker, well, you could certainly do that, and it would certainly be helpful. It's there's no bad outreach, I don't think. I got a question coming in from Marty. Let's get an answer to it. Waiting. Here we go. In answer to your question, Marty, no, and I don't know why Doris Matsui has not signed on yet, but if you can be some help in getting that done, we will be happy to go to her office. You can contact either the local or the D.C. office, and then we will follow up with a meeting request, because we're going to be here through the end of business Friday, a week from tomorrow. That leaves plenty of time to work in a whole bunch of meetings, and I sure hope that we can just pack the week full. By the way, a gentle reminder here at about 9 minutes past the hour: the only way that the horn stays on the air is through your kind contributions. Thank you very much for Tuesday's effort. You managed to. We managed to get all the way up to $95. We matched $95 of Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, and it meant a great deal. Now, last night not being on the air, there was no fundraising, even though the number remains the same. So we find ourselves this evening trying to raise somewhere around, well, technically speaking, $480 to catch up with the hole that we were in from the end of May, which had to do with the hole we were in from the end of April. And holes like that are what make it difficult for there to be, in this case, a July. July. So there we go. If we are to continue this effort, it is predicated upon your willingness to keep on seeing it keep on. And so, yeah, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. If, however, you prefer to use the traditional overland, over-air mail services, you're more than welcome to do that. And boss man Wayne is more than willing to go to the post office to pick him up. I talked to boss man Wayne earlier today, and he was met by a very sad, sad echo when he opened the mailbox earlier today. There was nothing there but bills. That traditional mail address is, of course, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. And, of course, a gentle reminder, when sending a contribution by mail like that, do not make a check or a money order payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not see it. It goes to pay our bills, and consequently just make it payable to The Horn or Head on Communications, and it'll be fine. So, this being Thorn in the Side Thursday, we have an abundance of work ahead of us. But, well, let's see. Let's go back. I want to start with an email from our buddy Chris in California, because it's a dandy. Chris writes, I was musing a bit about the conversations you'd had yesterday about so many Democrats voting against a GMO labeling law. We've been talking about that at some length because it's really quite shocking. I find, says Chris, people like Andy's confusion, Andy called in on Tuesday evening, about this laudable because it shows how much they believe in the decency of human beings generally. But when I hear that half the Democrats voted against a GMO labeling law, I can manage just two explanations for this. One, and this is the easy explanation, Chris says, is that they're simply bought out on this issue. The reasons why this may be easier to inflict on Democrats than you would expect is related to reason number two, but suffice it to say that the explanation they're in the pocket of Monsanto is pretty good, and I suppose we should count ourselves lucky that only half of them voted against it. We do know that Obama's cabinet is stuffed with Monsanto employees and consultants, all hucksters or legitimate brainwashies of the feed the world credo, or perhaps a bit of both. You know, that's the problem. Monsanto, we're going to feed the world. The only problem is they're not. A whole bunch of the world is starving. Vast swaths of the human population exist on way the hell less than 2,000 calories a day, and a whole bunch of those calories are largely empty and meaningless calories. Yeah, but you get the idea. So, number two, option two, according to Chris, the hard explanation is related to a suspicion or perhaps a theory that I've had over the years about atheists, agnostics in general. And I say this as one. People who value and cling to rationality may find in science a wee touch of the spiritual to the extent where it is possible to become dogmatic about it. Let's go back in time a bit. When I reached the conclusion about a decade ago that organized religion has about as much value and vitality as a sack of sawdust, I really think that's underestimating the sack of sawdust myself, Chris, but, you know, who the hell am I? And that humankind's limitless capacity to fool itself, a virtue as well as a vice, depending on how it's used, has resulted in large factions of the population remaining in perpetual fairy tale land, I appealed, as I have always done since I had the faculty, to rationality as a bastion of relative safety and made science, more or less, my religion. Science had advanced to the point where it was making transcendental claims when I was a child, after all. The origins and fate of the universe were being debated and studied, and it appeared like some really serious answers for serious-minded people were going to be forthcoming at any time. None of this 42 garbage. You know, 42. Life, the universe, and everything. 42. Science was my shield, Chris says, from the crazed religions because it was going to lead a path forward towards something real and achievable and beneficial. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, well, you know. And what was it? Dim Leader said, fool me twice, it won't get fooled again. Science is created by humans. It is run by humans, and humans are fallible. In greed-based societies such as ours, we foster and encourage sociopathy as a virtue, and science, like any other institution, can be swayed to some horrendous ends. Science, as an establishment, is also subject to its own prejudices, dogmas, and corruption, just as the church. Pure rationality is no shield for creatures that are not purely rational. Don't get me wrong, science is so awesome, it has still managed some incredible things, despite its inception by crazed apes, you know, that would be us, and is still our best, last hope for getting off this planet or saving it for a little while longer. I'm a science geek, Chris says. And, you know, sometimes as a, I like to kid myself that I'm a professional reader of words and knower of words, but that was science geek, not science Greek. I'm a science geek, Chris says, and am constantly marveling at my own lack of knowledge. I've recently started to kick myself for not studying botany at some point, but it's not too late, and it goes well with my newfound desire to do some wild food foraging. But my larger point is simply that I had a time in my life where I was becoming dogmatic about my attitude towards science, mocking those that didn't understand it or believe in it, the behavior I associate with religious types. How very odd. Luckily, cynicism got just a bit ahead of credulity thanks to monsters like Monsanto, Pfizer, and Exxon. That is rather a murderer's row, isn't it? They use science as a shield, too. And it works on people who are just big old fans of science, because the more weird second possibility as to why the Democrats voted as they did is, you might want to sit down for this one, many of them actually believe all the bullhonky that Monsanto throws down on their plates because, well, science is the way of the future. Future, future, future. And people that don't see that genetically engineered food comes from science and is hence inherently good because science are, well, science. They're dumbasses. Science! You know, I can never see the word science in quote and an exclamation point without something coming immediately to mind. In particular, this. Did he say she Tina Turner'd her eyes to me? I'm just checking. I'm the same guy who thought that Stevie Nicks was singing just like a one-winged dove makes a sound, sounds like she's saying, ooh, baby, ooh, said ooh. Because, you know, if you were a one-winged dove, you might say, ooh, baby, ooh, ooh. Tina Turner eyes to me. Well, anyway. Say it. Yeah, you get the idea. But yet, science! Right? So Chris wraps up saying, my feeling is old habits die hard. Atheism has not stopped my experimentation with various forms of Buddhist practice and philosophy, occultism, and other spiritual aids. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Because the need to feel a connection to a greater whole, my official working definition of spirituality, by the way, a connection to a greater whole, does not stop simply because you realize that most of the religions on offer are paths to arrested development. Whoa! Whoa, back up. Oh, that's toastery. The need to feel a connection to a greater whole does not stop simply because you realize that most of the religions on offer are paths to arrested development. Whew. Man, Mother McCree. You know, every now and then we get these little lines, and they, like the one from Dr. John last week, and I feel like they just need to go in banners over the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com website. This is one of those. The need to feel a connection to a greater whole does not stop simply because you realize that most of the religions on offer are paths to arrested development. Dang. I think if I had the money, I'd run to a tattoo parlor and just get that put on a little band around my bicep. And I'm not being a smartass. That's profound. So Chris continues, so I sometimes wonder if drifters latch on to science and it acquires a bit of the transcendental glow about it. Frankly, evolution is probably the most mind-crushing thing I've ever tried to come to grips with, and it provides a sense of amazement to me that I should think rivals the Jesus throes of any ecstatic Bible thumper. Or so I'd like to think. If evolution doesn't make you sit down and just reevaluate the universe, I would argue you have not understood it properly, which explains, of course, why religious types are against it. A bit rambling, this one, Chris says. Sorry, Bob. No apologies necessary, Chris. I love this stuff. What I was going to say was so clear until I started typing it. It's the way it works, isn't it? Thanks for your kind indulgence. Is this simply an admission of extreme naivete, or is there some sort of mental spiritual science crossover that is little recognized? My guess is it's a combination of both. One of the traps we build for ourselves happens when we try to pigeonhole things into just nice, neat little taxonomies. There is a mysticism to the universe because we don't have it nailed down. There's lots of stuff out there we don't understand yet. And so, as that wonderful line from Shakespeare in Love goes, how's it end? I don't know. It's a mystery. And it is. And it's okay to feel wonder at that sense of mystery. But by the same token, I think one of the things we're talking about is the co-opting of science by the profiteers. It is that brutal self-interest that says, I need to get wealthy at the expense of whomever I need to get wealthy at their expense of, which is, don't try to diagram that, you'll hurt yourself. And they'll co-opt economics. We've co-opted psychology and psychiatry for purposes of enhancing the misery of the lives of people who have never done us, you, me, our nation, and any harm. And there are people who hold licenses to practice psychiatry, psychology, nursing, and they have bent their will toward tormenting other human beings who happen to be wearing orange jumpsuits and follow the wrong religion and were in the wrong place at the wrong time and are now down at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And he or she goes home at night, the nurse, the shrink, the psych, whatever, and says, well, that was a long day. But that's okay. We've seen an abundance of examples of when science gets taken sideways. Well, hell's bells. The big breaking story today about Verizon, and of course by extension more than likely Sprint and T-Mobile and AT&T and all the other big carriers, having been harvested for your data and my data, well, guess what? That's another example of the co-option of science. It takes science to be able to set up the giant, massive supercomputer systems that go out and harvest the length of the duration and the number you called to find out old Aunt Edna's brownie recipe. And lo and behold, Everybody is out there, and I'm not criticizing them for doing it. I'm just sort of sitting here in slack-jawed wonder that the freak out is on now. That lo and behold, the government is spying on us and harvesting our cell phone records and our not even just cell phone records, it's everything. Because they're going to keep us safe from the terrorists because they hate us for our freedoms. Yes, Texas Betsy, yes, the brownie recipe. And occasionally, Agent Fred, are you listening? Occasionally, the black walnut fudge recipe. I said black walnut fudge. Mm-hmm. Okay. The people who needed to receive the message have now received the message. Black walnut fudge. Aunt Edna's black walnut fudge. Not Aunt Edna's peanut butter fudge. Aunt Edna's black walnut fudge. I don't know why anybody's surprised. The Republicans extended the domestic surveillance, the domestic spying bill, what, last December? A few Democrats here and there went, oh, but wait, could we have some civil liberties protections? We kind of like our civil lid, and we'd like to protect them. Sit down, commie. And so it got extended, and everybody is shocked, I tell you, shocked to find out that the Obama administration would engage in domestic spying when the Bush administration handed them the power to do it. And the people who are shocked, know absolutely not a damned blessed thing about how power works and how power, once acceded to or granted, becomes self-perpetuating. So, you know, if we want to talk this evening about the domestic spying scandal that's on the brew, sure. I just don't know why it's a scandal, and I don't know why anybody's surprised. But then again, I was out last night, so we didn't get to talk about the fact that, okay, go scream at the First Lady. You feel better now? Good for you. Good for you. You'll feel happy now. You can tell people at Thanksgiving dinners a generation from now, did I ever tell you the time I went down and screamed at the First Lady? Sit down, Granny. No, I don't think I told you. You know, I just love the idea that the NSA is out there sorting through phone calls. Actually, just, you know, numbers. It's kind of like when you click OK with Apple or Microsoft and say that you'll send them data. You're just sending them data so that they can make your experience better. And that's what America's doing there, making your American experience better by harvesting all of your communications information. Aren't you happier, citizen? Don't you feel so much more secure, citizen? Sit down, citizen. Be quiet, citizen. Don't criticize, citizen. Right? Sure. Why not? Yeah. No, but I just love the idea of the NSA out there crawling, burning up the memory and the massive processor time it takes to sort out the phone numbers of a couple of the recently hormonal 13-year-olds who are furiously, I mean, desperately calling. Ring, ring. No. And hang up because she loses her nerve or he loses his. And then finally, there's a connection. Hi. Hey. Hey. Well, hi. Hey. Yeah, what are you doing? Nothing. What are you doing? Oh, nothing. I just wanted to call it. Well, I like you. Do you like me? I like you. You like me? I like you. I like you, too. Have a fine effing time, Agent Fred. Have a blast. Enjoy checking out those connections between the new mommy and the new grandparents. Enjoy that. Because remember, this isn't just computers. There are human beings behind this. There are human beings who go home at the end of the day and pat themselves on the back because they're protecting America. You know, just like the lawful, awful gun owners are. They're protecting America. Yeah, Marty, I do too. I click cancel on the do you want to help us in Crit. No, I don't want to help you. You charged me a goddamn fortune for this computer program. I owe you precisely nothing. So, yeah, I click cancel too. The only problem is the American people didn't get a chance to click cancel. No, I do not want to help you. No, 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 no. Click, click, no. Hey, 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 you know, hey, guess where I am? Where? I'm at the Apple store. I got my new iPhone. Really? Yeah. You want to FaceTime? Yeah. Sleep tight tonight, America. The NSA is crawling through the minute, deadly dull, mind-numbingly banal detritus of your lives. But you know what? Senator Lindsey Graham Cracker, well, he pulled up to the closet door just long enough to say that, well, I'm perfectly fine with the government checking in on my eavesdropping on my phone calls because they're protecting me from terrorists, and I don't want the terrorists to carry me away and ravage me. Thanks, Huckleberry. Get on that line and ride back off into Narnia now. Senator Dianne Feinstein, of course, who has a real sense of connection to the 1%. Oh, Agnes asking, by the way. Hey, Bob, where do you think the NSA gets its porn? Yeah, we understand now. And cat pictures. Don't forget the cat pictures. But Dianne Feinstein says she's, well, you know, it's called freedom. Is that what she said? Somebody. It's called security. Oh, Jesus, Dianne. Is it that hard to actually be a damn... Well, then again, Democrat is a fluid term these days, isn't it? I go back to the story that engendered Chris's email. And Chris's email, in fact, has received a response. Andy writing in, on the Senator Bernie Sanders GMO amendment, S-965 amendment, a comment for Chris. He says, the amendment, S-965, was not asking the Senate to outlaw genetically modified organisms or engineered foods. We're just looking for disclosure, a label There's no ban here, just transparency. What did you do to this food? To me, this is a disclosure issue, a right to know. Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, DuPont, Bayer, BASF, ConAgra? Is ConAgra part of this? And the gang can splice, dice, and sell those DNA-modified foods to their heart's content. Just let me know they're doing it. Again, to me, this is a no-brainer. I've been told to stick to raw foods, stay away from foods foreign to organic nature. A matter of fact, I just got done taking some milk thistle and turmeric to calm my gut down. Can't I at least know what I'm buying and going to put in my easily non-agreeable stomach? But to provide this information sends a message with too many negatives. Too many folks like me won't buy the product. And again, this goes back to one of my favorite scenes in Joseph Heller's Catch-22, where Milo Minderbinder tries to get Yossarian to eat some of the chocolate-covered cotton because he's bought too much. And well, he's got a glut of Egyptian cotton on his hands, and he's got to do something with it. And he thought maybe he'd make chocolate-covered cotton and feed it to the troops. Come on, Yossarian, won't you just taste it? No. Well, why not, Yossarian? Because it's cotton. It's not food, even though you covered it in chocolate. Yeah, but it's good for M&M Enterprises, and everybody has a share. So that's where we are. And Andy is absolutely correct. The fact of the matter is, if you put a label on food that says this food contains X percentage of genetically modified ingredients, how many moms who love their children, how many dads who love their children, how many children who've learned from their moms and dads about giving a damn what they eat, how many of those are going to pick up a product with a label that says, contains 12% genetically modified organisms, and go, hey, Grandpa, what's for supper, and throw it in the buggy? Right? Because, see, it would be a real problem. Now, you know, my particular hang-up is number two field-grade corn, Roundup-ready corn, which, of course, is genetically modified by Monsanto, and I don't know, it's got a spliced-in gene from the pancreas of a shit weasel or something in it that makes it resistant to Roundup. And you can't eat it. You can boil it till hell freezes over, and it won't be good with butter and salt. You don't matter. You ain't eating it. The only thing you can do is feed it to some poor damn cow to bloat it and fatten it up in the last few weeks of its otherwise probably miserable life spent standing up to its kneecaps. Do cows have knees? In its own excrement. Sorry, dinner time. I know. All you can do with number two field grade corn is make either ethanol for additives to gasoline or, and this more importantly, high fructose corn syrup. Now, if you become conscious of high fructose corn syrup and you see how goddamn ubiquitous it is, their own pro-high fructose corn syrup commercial had a pair of mommies on the playground with popsicles. You want a popsicle? No, that's got high fructose corn syrup in it. Well, it's okay. It's just like any other sweetener. It's all right as long as you use it in moderation. Really? We have to describe popsicles made with high fructose corn syrup the way we'd describe 90-proof hooch? It's okay in moderation. But, yeah, we do. But see, everything that has in it high fructose corn syrup is going to have to be labeled as a genetically modified food if something like Senator Sanders' amendment were to go through. That means every bottle of Coca-Cola, every bottle of Pepsi, every bottle of 7-Up, every bottle of Sprite, every bottle of A&W root beer, every bottle of Dr. Pepper, every bottle except the stuff that's guaranteed not to have the godforsaken HFCS in it, every bottle of ketchup, every bottle, jar of pickles, really, bread and butter pickles, high fructose corn syrup. Okay, spaghetti sauce, high fructose corn syrup. Popsicles, yes, popsicles, high fructose corn syrup. Barbecue sauce, high fructose corn syrup. Maple syrup, yeah, maple syrup, maple flavored syrup, high fructose corn syrup. I mean, on and on and on. What was it that I picked up the other day? Cranberry juice, high fructose corn syrup. Hawaiian punch, fruit juicy red. How about a nice Hawaiian punch? High fructose corn syrup. Most lemonades, high fructose corn syrup. Many iced tea beverages, high fructose corn syrup. Someday, if you're just feeling adventuresome, go through the grocery store and just start noticing how many things have high fructose corn syrup in them, and then step back and realize that everything would, that if a labeling bill were to go through, all of that would have to be relabeled as containing genetically modified organisms. And you'll realize why these multinational, multi-billion, if not trillion-dollar corporations will move heaven and earth to keep from having to label it. Because, well, frankly, once that big label goes on, it might as well have a skull and effing crossbones on it. Right? So there you go. That explains it. Of course, the simple solution is to stop using that miserable shit. And going back to using, I don't know, cane or beet sugar, which isn't exactly good for you, but it doesn't process through the liver just like booze, and you never feel sick like you do from sugar, and it doesn't roast your pancreas over a merry little high-caloric chemical fire so that you wind up taking diabetes pills when you're effing 50. You get the idea. But that explains a lot of it. And so we go back to what Andy wrote. To provide this information sends a message with too many negatives. Too many folks like me won't buy this product. You know what? In Europe, they wouldn't buy it. I remember a year ago specifically looking at the ingredients label, which, albeit it was in German, I could dope out enough of it, though, to realize that high fructose corn syrup was not on the label because it ain't allowed there. Hell, Coca-Cola that comes from Mexico. I know this because I like this stuff. I know. Don't send me letters about how evil Coca-Cola is. I know. But if you want a Cuba Libre, you need Coca-Cola made from cane sugar, a lime, and some good rum. Just saying. Coca-Cola that comes from Mexico is made from cane sugar. Probably because they've got a sugar industry, and they don't want it buried underneath the rolling behemoth of Monsanto's Roundup. Yeah, you know, we stopped on the way over here just to look out over this historic area. There's nothing there except it used to be the site in 1759 of one of a string of forts that was on the frontier, the western frontier of the colonies at the time. Now it's in Augusta County, Virginia, where once stood Fort Dickinson. George Washington surveyed it. George Washington was central to its construction and, well, not one of his great strategic moments because it was built in 1759 and the natives burned it down in 1760. They rebuilt it and the natives burned it in 1761. They rebuilt it on a swamp. It burned down, fell over, and then sank into the swamp. But no. But it's gone now, but you can see that the plain of the cow pasture river and everything and well, yeah. I just have a hard time envisioning agrarian champions like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson saying, "Forsooth, someday I hope in our new country that the hardworking farmers tilling the soil and tending not only to their crops but to their freedom can be raising corn with the gene from the pancreas of a shit weasel spliced into it." See, I don't see that. Do you? No. And Andy adds, by the way, I hate Senator Feinstein on this one. Fourth Amendment, forget it. We're in a state of never-ending war, you know. She's so bad. So damn bad. And she is. There's no getting around it. Going back to the domestic spying issue, Cassie writes in from Princeton. Cassie Perrin, now a senior. Holy crap. Cassie's a senior in college. Oh, my God. Now, Cassie says to the subject line, my generation and privacy. Our parents watched our phones. Our schools censored our Internet access, and we always knew they had the right to search our physical and electronic possessions. No one my age even expects the government to keep out of our lives and communications. So, in other words, Cassie, what you're saying is First Amendment, what First Amendment? Yeah. Jack writes in from Shreveport, Bob, oh, crap. What involuntarily popped into mind during this discussion of food labeling was the pink slime and the related, in my mind, meat that had some kind of injection of gas that made it look fresher. I forgot the name of the gas. Nitrogen, methane, benzene, ethane. I'm making things up here, Jack says. Also, I'm just waiting for my cable modem or power to go off, as it has already done once today. No, we don't need no spending on our infrastructure. Jack, is it winking in and out because of the possible arrival of our first tropical storm of the hurricane season? Hurricane season opened on June the 1st, and lo and behold, here it is, June the 6th, and guess what? Yeah. Hurricane about to whack the Florida Gulf Coast, maybe mess up Alabama, create some tornadoes, screw up things in South Carolina, North Carolina, God knows where. Ain't no climate change, though. Damn. Yeah. Wow, you reckon we've got anything to talk about tonight? And by the way, thank you. Thank you to Henry. Thank you to Brian. Thank you to Horzak, otherwise known as Horst. He said, I sure hope this works. Say hi to boss man Wayne. It worked, Horst. It worked. Thank you very much. So now, in this first 48 minutes of the program, we have raised $120 of what is closer to $400 that we need to raise this evening, or at least three. So that's proof positive that it can be done if we all just kind of chip in together. 120. Thank you very much. Thank you, all of you who are helping out. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. And, of course, the snail mail address is there under the tab Contribute as well. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, so there we were. Cassie pointing out that the First Amendment has never really been that much of a reality for her generation. So, I mean, so does your generation just assume it's sort of a naturally kind of thing that the government is going to spy on you? That's more than a little disturbing. But entirely within the realm of possibility. And you know what? You got a real problem when not only do people not understand the workings of the First Amendment, they don't even know it's the, well, the First Amendment. And that's trouble in River City. I've got all these weird little fantasies that run around in my head, and no, not those. Yeah, that's true, Agnes. Understanding that there is a First Amendment. That's where Dr. Bill comes in. Amen. You know, he's done for the week here, but starting on Monday at 4 p.m., Tuesday at 4 p.m., Wednesday at 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. each evening, Dr. Bill O'Brien and the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution of the United States. You're not going to get taught about the Constitution by anybody better anywhere on the planet than Dr. Bill O'Brien. It is, if I dare say, among the most important radio that is happening in this country today, period. Kath, thank you very much. We are now at $145, nearly only $5 away from halfway done for tonight. Thank you very much. No, before we run screaming into the night with the end of the first hour and the end of the filibobster, like I said, I have these weird little fantasies that sometimes happen inside my mind. Just can't be helped. You remember, and yes, everything's a movie reference with me. You remember the scene from Animal House when all the guys from the Delta House are sitting there in the auditorium being lectured, and they start sneeze, you know, the fake sneeze. Bullshit. Bullshit. Yeah, remember that? Yeah. I have this fantasy. Is it a deep, dark fantasy? I don't know. I like to think it's a fun fantasy. I have a fantasy that maybe there would be enough. I don't know. How about the Congressional Progressive Caucus? Every time Louis Gohmert approaches the lectern, that a whole bunch of smart alecky members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus start fake sneezing. Asparagus! 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 You know, something like that. If I was Louie, I'd keep my dang head down for a little while till the whole asparagus thing blew over. Are you casting aspersions on my asparagus? But no, I guess Louie lives in this bubble where nobody tells him when he's busy being an idiot. Jack asking from Shreveport, Bob, are you meaning to say the Fourth Amendment? Because you were talking about privacy in the Verizon bugging case. I walk in and out of the room, so I miss stuff, and Cassie was talking about privacy. Well, yeah, but also at the same time, yeah, it's Fourth Amendment stuff, but you know what? What kind of freedom of speech do you have when the government is watching all of it? And I guess that's the question that I was asking, and maybe sort of tangentially pointing out that there are, and there was another reason I did that. Let's see. And that's this. But, no, Jack is quick on the uptake, so I did not get away with it. Wow, really cool little group in the chat room tonight. If you've never been to the chat room, head on RadioNetwork.com chat room. tonight would be a great time to pop in. Oh, heck, Benedict's in there, Brian's in there, Kath from Canada, and Dwayne, and HZ, and Sergi, and, well, bye, Brian. And Stockton, Larry, and Waggy, and Texas Betsy, and Sparky, and Lottie, they're all in there. Pop by sometime and just say hi, just to be neighborly. But no, and oh, by the way, thank you, Ed. Between Ed and Kath and Horst and Henry and Brian, lo and behold, let's see, that's, oh, I've got to do the math on the fly now. It's kind of tough, sorry. And that, and carry the 12. Wow, yeah, we're getting there. 180. 180 bucks in fundraising this evening, so thank you very much. Jack noting, yeah, I always think about the chilling effect on the free speech issue, because it's real. But part of it was me trying to work my way around to this, to being a little bit cute about the latest installment of Life with Louie. I don't mean Anderson. No, not by any stretch of the imagination do I mean Anderson. I mean Gohmert, down there in one of America's most bizarre congressional districts, the Texas 1st Congressional District. You may recall that on Tuesday night, Sergi told us a little bit about the 1st Congressional District of Texas. Well, somebody told legislating Louie all about the fact that that Kenyan Muslim socialist with a deep-seated hatred of white people, how he's got his government spying on us so they can figure out who to send to the FEMA re-education camps firstestest. Naturally, legislating Louie took to the floor.
And in this order that is granting the request of this Justice Department under this Attorney General, who is under fire for other issues, it says the court, having found that the application of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is under the auspices of the Attorney General, the Justice Department,
Louis,
for an order
requiring... Louis, do you realize that you're... It sounds like you're chewing on your chicken fried snake or something that you had for lunch, and you're doing it into the microphone, or you got some double bubble or something. It's not exactly statesmanlike, Louie, but, well, then again, neither are you. But let's continue.
Requiring production of tangible things from Verizon Business, et cetera, court finds that it satisfies the requirements of 50 U.S.C. Section 1861. And it goes on to say that, accordingly, these things are ordered. And it orders, and I'm quoting now, an electronic copy of the following tangible things: all call detail records or telephony metadata.
Telephony metadata. Telephony metadata. The password is telephony. You know, that's when a fraud is practiced on you with the telephone. It's a telephony. Because it's not telegenuine. Telephony. Telephony, metadata, metadata. How was the macaroni and cheese down there in the Longworth cafeteria today, Louie? I realize it's probably a bit much to ask of a member of the House of Representatives, especially a Republican one, to actually be a practitioner of the art of word knowing. My buddy Joe over on Facebook enjoys it when I talk about the art of knowing words. Yep, they put it right there. You know what? If I was a resident of Tyler, Longview, or Nacogdoches, I would write to C-SPAN and say, take the name of my town off from underneath there. This is a public embarrassment. Maybe it was banana pudding for dessert. Telephony. I mean, does one have to be sort of some sort of insider to understand, or is this a function of the art of word knowing to understand that this is telephony? Or does legislating Louis also say telepathy? Right. Can't even spell it. Telephony metadata. Metadata. Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, Agnes, wasn't that a line from Overboard? Telephony, I need you. Jesus. We'll go to the phones in just a minute. I just want to finish up with legislating Louis real quick.
Created by Verizon for communications, one between the United States and abroad, or two, wholly within the United States, including local telephone calls.
Not telephony? Oh, well.
Further down, it says telephony metadata includes comprehensive communications, routing information, including but not limited to session identifying information, originating and terminating telephone number, international mobile subscriber identity number, international mobile station equipment identity number, trunk identifier, telephone calling card numbers, and time and duration of call. The telephony metadata does not include the substantive content of any communication as defined by 18 U.S.C. section 2510, subparagraph 8, or the name, address, or financial information of a subscriber or customer. Now, this comes on the heels of information about just how invasive this administration had gotten.
Got that? How invasive this administration had gotten. Except for the fact that legislating Looney Louie thought this was just fine as long as we was hunting down the tourists under our brilliant maximum mother of all leaders, the dim leader George W. Bush. In fact, Looney Louie probably voted to reauthorize this last December. Yeah. Yeah.
Information of a subscriber or customer. Now, this comes on the heels of information about just how invasive this administration had gotten when they went after the records of the Associated Press, the phone information of many, many phone numbers. And
any guesses on the over and under for impeachment proceedings over this? Just saying.
Some of them coming from right up here in the area where the reporters use. This is
complicated term, that, the area where the reporters use. I don't really know what that means.
This is in the United States Capitol. Many times these phones up here are used by reporters to call members of Congress who have another constitutional privilege under the constitutional.
Stop it. Who have another constitutional privilege under the constitutional. Oh, that weren't no macaroni and cheese at lunch, were it, Louie? No, you had some 90-proof lunch, I'm guessing.
The Constitution that provides privilege for the information that is provided to a member of...
8, 4, 2, 7, 9, 731, 12.
Congress. It's not unlimited, but that's on top of the freedom of the press. It's also...
No, wait, wait, wait. I just want to prepare you, because this is the strap in with the tennis ball and the duct tape. You know, because there's going to be screaming. This is a 4-minute and 7-second clip. We've been through 3 minutes and 9 seconds of it. But I it would be unfair of me just to let this bomb, don't say bomb, Bob, Agent Fred's listening, just to let this thing land on you without some kind of warning. So you're warned. Just sort of hang on to the chair arm or brace yourself against a table or, you know, whatever it was that Jim Kirk and the guys on the bridge of the Enterprise did when they were getting ready to get rocked by a disruptor or something from Klingons or, you know, fire! Right.
Adds privilege for the information that is provided for to a member of Congress. It's not unlimited.
Jesus, he went to law.
But that's on top of the freedom of the press that's also granted in the Second Amendment. It is amazing.
Whoa. There it was. It just the breeze is right past, and you don't even know it's there until the hunter seeker is already under your skin. Did you catch that?
Provides privilege for the information that is provided for to a member of Congress. It's not unlimited, but that's on top of the freedom of the press that's also granted in the Second Amendment.
The freedom of the press that's granted in the Second Amendment. There. You heard it. I heard it. Holy cow. The Second Amendment has everything in it. Guns, freedom of the press, frisbees, wheat checks, Jesus. Agnes just said to me, I feel so good about myself when I listen to Louis Gohmert. As you should, dear. As you should. The Second Amendment guarantees freedom of the press. Well, nothing stops a bad government tyranny like a well-armed reporter. We're almost done.
And it is amazing when our attorney general said...
Now, did you notice he didn't say, oh, I meant the first, or, oh, I, that, the fourth, or... The, no, it's... It, no, the whole Constitution's in Louis' Second Amendment. Bless his heart. Poor Jeremy writes in from Vermont. Bob, I'm running low on tennis balls and duct tape. Send more real quick. Horst reminding us all under the subject line, Louis Gohmert, lest we ever forget, not only did this numbnuts go to law school, he was actually a judge. Can you imagine sitting in the dock and being sentenced to prison by this asshat? I would prefer not to. Then Sergi, who is playing the home game tonight, constitutional rights under the Constitution? Greetings and hello, my name and what they call me is... Whoop! Greetings and hello, my name and what they call me is Louis Gohmert. You have contacted and reached the Department of Redundancy Department. Thanks for calling and dialing your phone. I'm Louis Gohmert. What is the reason and purpose of your call today on this fine Thursday? Signed, Sergi. Hi, my name is Sergi. Kyle. My name and what they call me. All right, we're almost done.
In essence, this was like the most egregious or one of the most egregious national security leaks I'd ever heard about.
Missed that whole Bush administration.
It was so serious. We had to go after this material, and then we find out there were only a handful of people in the entire administration who knew.
Administration.
The information that got leaked. There was a tweet today by Ace of Spades.
Because that's what I want out of my really, really thoughtful member of the House, a tweet from Ace of Spades.
The tweet was, "We've all got an Obama phone now." Well, apparently we do, because this administration is following every call being made by every phone in America, at least the ones on Verizon, so that leads you to believe they've probably gotten it from other information, too.
And no, Louis had absolutely nothing, I tell you, nothing to do with the reauthorization of that program, even if he did. Well, apparently Sergi got to Jack in Shreveport. Ha, 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 writes Jack. Sergi's joke totally cracked me up. It busted me pretty good, too. I tell you what, the filibobster is done for this evening, I do believe. It's about 11 minutes past the hour, and we are at $230 for fundraising this evening. Can you imagine that? $70 more, and we will have reached the minimum threshold for the evening. Wowzer. Thank you, everybody. Let's go to the phones. Agnes tells me that Dr. John is on the line.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Dr. John. How are you?
Well, I'm good, but God, that was Gohmert. That was painful.
Yeah, it hurts real bad. I mean,
what does it take to conjure up the spirits of Quincy Adams and Thaddeus Stevens to come back and school that dude on how to be an effective representative?
I don't even know if that's possible. You know, when you sit down, and Dr. Bill's pointed this out, John, when you sit down and you deliberately read the language that was used by the likes of a James Madison, I mean, can you imagine? It's tough, even if you're kind of used to reading that kind of legalese. I can't imagine Louis trying to read Federalist number 42 or whatever without picking his teeth with his toenail clippings.
That's an image. Hey, didn't you say he went to A&M?
Yes. Yeah. And he was president. He was class president or troop leader or den mother or whatever you get to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, folks from Texas know A&M's rep. Not thought of as, you know, the place where the smartest kids in the state go. You know, that third tier talk guy out of Atlanta. Not going to say his name. He's a proud A&M alum.
Is he really? I had no idea.
Yes, he is.
I keep waiting for him to fly his plane into a tree or something.
Yeah. Listen, what I wanted to call in and give a report. Last night, I saw Gasland Part 2 at a screening here in Binghamton, and I wanted to just tell some folks about it.
Oh, do please.
Yeah, it was great. I guess it's going to be on HBO in July, but before that, the director's doing a grassroots tour. They're going to different cities around the country, usually, you know, small towns. And last night in Binghamton was their first stop in New York State. So folks who are in here might find a screening near them. Go to GaslandTheMovie.com. You can see when it's going to be around. But real quick, it was really outstanding. Here in Binghamton, there were, I stopped counting at 300. It was a hell of a crowd. And this is significant because this is sequel to Gasland, and it's about, you know, the effects of drilling, especially in the Marcellus Shale, but essentially all shale gas drilling, and the effects it has on the communities and the water around where this happens. It's an update to the first movie. And this is significant here because Binghamton, New York, we're upstate. You know, this is going to be ground zero if New York State allows hydraulic fracturing to go ahead. And we're going to find out about that probably in the next year or so. So I would highly suggest folks go see the movie. It's good. It does a couple things really effectively. One is drawing connections between just the effects of resource extraction, natural gas and oil. And early on, he draws a really great parallel between gas extraction and the BP spill in the Gulf. And that sounds at first maybe a little strange because they're two different processes, but the point that's made early on in the movie is, you know, as far as, you know, BP and Shell and the oil companies are concerned, you know, you can spill oil in the Gulf. You can wreck the ecosystem. You can screw up people's lives because there's still oil there. And that's what they're after. Everything else is externalized. And the same mindset obtains for natural gas drillers.
Absolutely.
You know, it doesn't really matter if we pollute the water and the air. It doesn't matter if we screw up people's wells because that's not what we're about. We're about extracting shale gas. And no matter how much we pollute, there's still gas down there.
And right, and pollution is really not part of the equation at all, is it?
Well, no, it's not because they're not on the hook for that. You know, they'll get little fines here and there if, you know, it's obvious that wells are contaminated, but basically, the more they do it, the harder it becomes to really come after them. It's worth seeing. They go to Australia, talk about fracking down there, talk about polluted water down there. Some great scenes from fracking in Wyoming and down in Texas. The big reveal to me is how just pervasive this practice is. It's going on everywhere. And I didn't really realize that, I think.
Well, yeah, because you don't have to have Marcellus shale in order for the idea of fracking to be, or for the practice of fracking to be deemed viable for your community. It can go into all kinds of different formations, right? It's a methodology and not a brand specific kind of thing.
Yeah, it works if there's shale rock below ground that traps gas. So, they're doing it in Australia. There's an enormous shale formation, the Monterey Shale, under California. And it also happens to be right on top of the San Andreas Fault and extending under the Central Valley, which, as you know, is where a huge proportion of our food comes from. And I had no idea that that was there and that they're thinking about fracking there. There's a fracking operation in the center of L.A. I had no idea.
And one suspects if the people of L.A. had any idea, there would probably be something approaching serious civil unrest.
Yeah, you would think so, but I guess it's hidden in plain sight. The big thing from the movie, which I think is really great and actually resonates with some things we've talked about and some things Dr. Bill has talked about, it's not really a movie about what is fracking. I mean, they assume that people know. It's not even necessarily really about really about the effects. It's about how drilling companies and politicians and courts manage the message. And it makes the point. It's very clear that there's a coordinated effort here to obfuscate, to push alternative narratives, and to marginalize people who are against hydraulic fracturing. And that's, to me, the big impact of the movie. And, of course, I was thinking about what Dr. Bill talked about the Powell memo. And all the work that John Marshall did to ensure that corporations were protected with the judgments he made. You know, why is the Supreme Court so concerned that corporations and charters are safe? You know, that seems so odd to me. It's still happening. You know, the movie presents these secret memos from different drilling companies. It talks about how the EPA gets leaned on by politicians to certify well water as safe, even when it's clearly not. It's really chilling in a way.
Well, it's more than chilling. And let me just ask you a straight up question. When we talk about what Dr. Bill says about John Marshall and how this country from its outset was more or less designed to be a safe place for commerce to run wild, was that something that you were considering before you ever met Dr. Bill, so to speak? I mean, what has the net effect of what he's been talking about been for you?
No, that was completely off my radar. He's building a very, very convincing argument. But I had never considered that. I mean, the revelation about the 14th Amendment being about the roots of corporate personhood, that shocked me. And the more he's talking about it, the more it's making sense. So, no, this is opening my eyes in a lot of ways.
And I guess the question is, what is it? Does the fact, Dr. John, that this has been the ongoing sort of obfuscated mission of this country, does that spell our eventual doom, or do you see remedies?
You know, my thing about the idea of sort of protecting corporations, that it seems to elevate these artificial entities to something a cut above regular people. But it's people that make up boards of directors. It's people that make up corporate charters. It's people that make up all institutions. You know, we talk about Washington doing this, but that's bogus. It's goofy. I mean, Washington is made up of living people with motivation, you know. And I think that it seems like to me that there's a shell game going on where we try to deflect blame from individuals onto these fake corporate or institutional entities. And I think that if there is a solution, it's being able to pierce through that veil in a way. I don't know how you do that, but I don't think we're doomed. I think we need to recognize that people are responsible for their actions, and in some way, this legal mumbo jumbo of making corporations like people with rights, but also immortal and also basically unpunishable has to be dealt with. It's not very satisfying, I know.
Well, no, it's not a question of whether it's satisfying or not. It's a question of whether it's achievable. Because while boards of directors are made up of people, they're not made up of what I like to refer to as ordinary people. They're made up of 1% people, at least where, you know, the boards of your Exxons and your Cabot Energy and, you know, the Chesapeake and all of that. Let me back up to the fracking issue for a minute, John. You said you quit counting at 300 people for the film last night. Were these people who seemed to already understand the issue and were there to get more information, or did you get the sense that these were people who might need persuading?
No, it was a very friendly crowd. They were ready to clap. There was a couple of gas trolls. You could tell they had their T-shirts on and they sat on their hands, you know. And I bailed early on the Q&A, but it was clear that there was some division there. But by and large, there didn't seem to be many undecided folks. I think you'd expect, you know, for something like this.
Wow.
Which is troubling, though, because we hear that a lot of people don't really know about fracking. Something like 50% don't really have never heard the phrase, which seems a bit unusual to me because it's everywhere. And you know, it was very striking. They talked about how the strategy of people like Cabot and Chesapeake is to put up bogus science or create the impression that there's debate about this, which is the same that's happening with climate change. You know, if you can hire a couple
or teach the controversy. Creationism,
right.
Intelligent design, evolution.
Right, right, exactly, right. As if this false parity equals, you know, actual dissent. It doesn't, you know, and it's very clear from this that it's not going to be our political system as it is set up right now that's going to stop it, because there's too much money involved, there's too much lobbying involved. You know, it's going to take people that are organizing on a community level, it's going to probably take, you know, different kinds of action by certain people who want to do that sort of thing. But you can't vote away fracking. Both parties are on board with it, you know.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like that GMO issue that Andy was raising. When you can only get 26 Democrats in the Senate to vote in favor of an amendment that would just merely allow people to know that there are GMOs in their food, what does that say about the other 25 to 24 Democrats? You know, it's not a Republican or Democrat issue.
Yeah. No, it isn't, but there's something hidden there, and that's what you're suggesting, and I think it's what they're afraid of, is that people won't buy it if it says that, and I think that that's true. You know, so I think that this huge undecided or ignorant in a, you know, in the true sense of the word, people who don't know about this, if they're informed about GMOs, they're informed about hydraulic fracturing, you got to think that there's going to be, you know, opposition to it. I think the companies, the fact that the companies are afraid of that tells me that they think the same thing. So that's encouraging in a sense. So it takes education and outreach and agitation to raise the word. Like the fact that, okay, I had a Cornell professor who studies, you know, drilling technology, and he says, you know, every well you sink, the concrete is going to fail 5% of the time immediately. That's just what happened. And in that light, we see these articles coming out of Pennsylvania where it says, you know, drill contamination in well waters, you know, in 5 or 6% of the wells. All of a sudden, that takes on a whole different tenor to me. It's not that it's not happening very much. It's that it's happening as they know it's going to happen, if you follow me.
Yeah.
So that's a really effective point to make, I think. It's not – the fact is they know that this sometimes isn't going to work, and they're okay with it because, again, they don't care about people's water. They care about extracting the shale gas for export to China. There's that.
Jesus. Yeah. Well, and that losses like that, and it teaches us a little bit about the economics of it, that things like that are acceptable. They're just acceptable.
Right.
And I find that stunning.
Yeah.
Or at least I don't understand the economics behind it. So.
Well, I think you understand the economics really well. It's the fact that we socialize loss and risk. Right? I mean, that's when
right, right. But profits get, profits are capitalized.
Are privatized, capitalized, sure. So, I mean, when this little town, 2 years back in PA, their wells were polluted, right? So my city trucked water down there, you know, free of charge. Free of charge. I mean, I paid for it and I'm happy to do that.
Right.
But in another sense, it's Cabot's responsibility, but they don't need to do that because they can get sympathetic judges and sympathetic local politicians to get them off the hook for it. And that's a problem. You know, if corporations are individuals and individuals are supposed to have personal responsibility, then they need to have personal responsibility. To me, it's a very clear sort of line there that needs to change. How, I don't know.
Well, I don't either. And of course, everybody's waiting for unless I misread all the news, everybody's waiting for the other shoe to drop in New York right now, aren't they?
Yeah, Cuomo's gonna make his decision before the next election is the word. So, we'll see. But it's gotta stop because, I mean, there's shale everywhere. 5% failure rate in 50 years, it's a 50% failure rate. You know, these wells aren't gonna go away. They can't sink anymore. You know, and so I highly recommend checking out the movie. I have some sort of critiques of it, but I think I'll send you an email or something.
Okay. Well, did they say anything about general availability of the film beyond these little screenings and stuff?
Yeah, no, they didn't, and I should have asked because it's going to be on HBO, and in a sense, that's a good thing. But boy, that's a walled off garden. It's inaccessible to a lot of folks.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of hate to hear it because that means it's just gate kept. I guess maybe the rest of us proles can wait till it hits Netflix or something.
Well, if it's HBO, it probably won't show up on Netflix instant. At least it would be on the disc version. But I mean, I think my hope is that it would get a theatrical release. At least that would help. But then again, it's not going to go everywhere. And that's a problem. Yeah, because you know, we can't ignore. This is part of my critique is that they really gloss over the sort of class issue. You know, it's no good to have this if folks can't see it and can't send it around. But
well, exactly, and
not my decision.
And of course, messaging, and you know, you've got to entertain at the same time that you're teaching. And I hate to admit that, but you probably, having been in a classroom, know that better than I do. And
absolutely.
And it's so frustrating as we sit and try to figure out, you know, how do we teach people about mountaintop removal? How do we teach them about fracking? How do we teach them about the Keystone XL pipeline? And I think the secondary issue, and I'm not trying to run too far off the topic, but I'm interested in your take on this real quick, John. The other part of this is, how do we teach people that these are not separate issues, that they are the same issue? I mean, I was having a conversation in one of our meetings last night, and I brought up something that I said a couple of years ago when the Deepwater Horizon rig was spewing filth into the Gulf, and I was deeply frustrated, frankly, and I said, maybe if we transport a couple of dead oil-covered dolphins up onto a mountaintop, people would understand the gravity of mountaintop removal. And there's still a certain truth that attaches to that. And I guess I'm talking about movement building or community building or org. I don't know what the word is, but how do we teach people that even though it may feel like your ox is the one getting gored, that everybody's riding the same ox?
This really, really strong and problematic idea out there that we're all sort of separate individuals, you know, like the idea that community isn't something that exists is a real problem, and it stands in the way of that. We think that our personal oppression is the only problem in the world, you know. And that's a huge problem too when we're talking about, you know, I'm a white guy. I mean, I'm dripping with privilege. And I, you know, if I talk about how I'm oppressed, it sounds kind of hollow, you know, but we need to be able to connect those things. I think environmental issues, health and human rights issues are a good way to do it. Talk about mountaintop removal, about fracking. The idea is that these pollute water. We all drink water. You know, fracking in northeastern Pennsylvania threatens the aquifer for New York City. You know, all that stuff, I think, can clarify to people that, wow, what happens in my backyard is actually connected to everything else. That might be an entry point. But you're right. I mean, oppression in any form, I strongly believe this, is connected to all other kinds. You know, and I think environmental things are a clear way to do that, because we all got to breathe, we all got to drink, we all got to eat.
Yeah, it's like that thing I've said from time to time that, you know, you can go 30 days without food, 3 days without water. Try going 3 minutes without air.
Yeah.
And then the perspective, that air and that water, and, of course, the Maslow hierarchy of needs, you know, it all kicks in. And it's easy to understand when it's your air, your water, your shelter that's under assault. But the burning question for anybody who's involved in all this stuff is, how do you get people out of their comfort zones? How do you get them fired up? And how do you make them understand that they're next? I mean, I just got an email in from Jack in Shreveport, Dr. John. He says, down here in the Shreveport region, it's called the Haynesville Shale.
Yeah, yeah.
And in managing the message, the politicians always say, well, this is going to be the Saudi Arabia of the Haynesville Shale.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when Barack Obama swanned around southern Illinois and into West Virginia and Ohio and said, I want Appalachia to be the Saudi Arabia of coal. And I don't mean to be an ass or anything, but I don't want to be the Saudi Arabia of anything.
Well, no, but there's a secret truth to that statement, and that shale gas and that coal, you know, it is going to trickle down to Saudi Arabia, because once we hit peak oil, or once we can't, you know, profitably extract oil anymore, it's going to be shale gas. And then we're going to have a shale gas economy, and that's going to get shipped to where the price is best. It's going to be China. It's going to be Japan, India, Russia, the Middle East. Once they're out of oil, they're going to need energy, and it's going to be our gas. So in a sense, it is going to be the Saudi Arabia of shale oil, but I don't think we need to power Saudi Arabia.
No, and beyond that, I think there's another hidden truth in there, Dr. John, that it's going to be the Saudi Arabia of shale gas or the Saudi Arabia of coal, insofar as, hey, look, human rights have gone down the toilet wherever there's a Saudi Arabia of something.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Dr. John, I'm glad you went. I really appreciate the report back on the film, and I hope I get to see it soon. I have reason to think I might. But I'm really, really looking forward to it. Let me ask you this simply. Is this and of course it's Josh Fox we're talking about. Is this the equal of his first work?
Yeah, it is. I don't think it has an aha moment like when the guy lit his water on fire, because now we all know about that. You know, that happened several times, but it's good. It's thoughtful, and it brings the issue into the present and shows very clearly how this is a huge threat. It's getting worse, and it threatens people who aren't even directly connected to it. And that's valuable. Touches on what you were asking about earlier.
Well, Dr. John, I hope things are going well back up there in Bingo, and our best to you and your family, and our best for the future as well. It's nice to be hearing from you, although I know you miss school now that it's out.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks very much, and thanks for the work you're doing in D.C. Appreciate it.
It's mighty interesting, if nothing else. Dr. John, take care. Bye now.
All right, cheers, Bob. Bye.
Dr. John calling from New York State. Keep an eye out for it, either on HBO or if you happen to live in East Frakistan, maybe there will be a screening coming your way of Gasland 2. It'll be worth your effort to go and see it. Well, dang. We've already blown more than halfway through the program here, 24 minutes before the hour. We'll take a little break. Kind of need one. Let me go to the email first. Jack writing in with a couple of comments. He says, you know, it's what Dr. John said about people being in charge of corporations, and then further in y'all's conversation, talking about an economic argument rather than a social one. I just don't think that we should make an economic argument without the context of a social one. And I agree. It's this false dichotomy that there's business that exists in some separate universe apart from the planet we all have to live on. That, of course, that's all encapsulated in that wonderful little sign epigram or whatever that you'll see at the occasional rally or march or protest. There is no planet B. This is the one we're on, because we ain't yet figured out how to get off in any real numbers. Jack noting also, I've still been personally unable to grasp the mindset and drive that certain individuals can maintain, the will to pass down through the generations the raw greed and brutality necessary to do what these freaks are doing to other human beings. No, it's because you're not as spiritually or psychically twisted as the profit monkeys are. All right, so if you are on hold, and you know the number, 304-658-3333, if you're on hold, please stay that way. We've got to take a little bit of a break, and we'll be back. This is what we like to call conversation radio. Oh, goody. Got a giggle out of Sandra with Louis Gohmert a little bit ago. A giant L-O-O-O-O-O-O-L. This mofo has overtaken Al Sharpton. Woo! All right, break time. Don't do that to a guy. Oh, that was hard. All right. We'll take a break and come back. This is Conversation Radio, and it's deeply inspiring to see that we are, you guys are involved in keeping things on the air, because we're doing considerably better. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Diane. Thanks, Horst. Thanks, Henry. Thanks, Brian. Many thanks. All the way around. It's exactly how we keep all of this going. Thanks, Kath. It's deeply appreciated. like I said, a break, and then we come back. This is The Horn.
Time is pie, just water for the...
Okay, so sorry about that. I guess we overran our little break. But anyway, welcome back. You didn't go anywhere. 11 minutes before the hour, we are an hour and pretty much 50 minutes into tonight's little 3 hours of conversation radio. And we'll fire it up and go back to, let's see, Agnes tells me that Edward is on the line.
Hello?
Hey, Edward.
Yeah. We were talking about Louis Gohmert.
Yes.
And asparagus. And I told Agnes about this film festival, the animated film festival that we had here in Dallas several years ago at this lovely theater. And one of the cartoons was named Asparagus. And it was an asparagus patch with this sort of lovely lady from the waist down. And I can't tell you what the asparagus was doing to her.
Oh, dear.
I would like to have Louis Gohmert thrown into hell and have the same thing done to him for all eternity.
Sounds like a lovely idea.
Yeah, I thought so. Anyway, if you... Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, if you want to see the cartoon Asparagus, you can get it on Google, and it warns you that it has adult content.
Okay.
It's very unusual. And I just wanted to wish this upon our dear friend Louis.
for whom a free press is enshrined in the Second Amendment, and so too is probably America's right to freely eat asparagus.
Yes, absolutely. So y'all take care and remember asparagus. And if you want to look it up on Google, you might find it rather amusing. But don't show it to the children.
And not safe for work either, I'll warrant.
Depends on how old the people you're working with.
Well, true.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Ferg, he's old enough to see it. He probably would think it would be very funny.
Oh, dear. I may have to look it up. Edward, you have yourself a good evening. Good to hear from you.
You do, too. And remember our dear friend, Gohmert, and asparagus forever.
Indeed. Edward, have a good evening. Bye now. And, Agnes, you tell me we've got John next?
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, hey.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, yeah, Bob, it's John.
Yeah.
Yeah, as far as the what you were talking about like community and empathy and stuff, I mean, where do you think that actually falls into America realistically? I mean, obviously we're not just a bunch of square, apathetic idiots, but at the same time, it's like, I mean, I don't really think that's encouraged, you know, unless you're playing a sport.
I don't think you can say that America is all of anything, John. But I think we have severe education problems in this country, and we have severe deliberate miseducation problems in this country.
Right. Where do you think that stems from? Because I mean, I know back in like the 50s, I mean, they weren't teaching anyone anything back in those days. It was just, you know, see something run and then go to college and learn the basic stuff. And then, you know, it's kind of like that Pete Seeger song, Little Boxes.
Right.
I mean, I just think that it's like, there's only so much, as far as education, it's like that's such a non-subject. It's, I mean, I don't even know what we rank, but it's got to be behind what, like China and India? At least.
Oh God, we rank behind so many countries educationally that it'll wear you out just reading the people who are whipping our butts. But it's the kind of education too. I mean, for instance, me being 50 years old, I graduated from high school in 1981. I actually had civics in ninth grade. Shortly thereafter, civics stopped being a subject. It just got enfolded into, I don't know, government or something. Because in my curriculum in high, in this public school, Alabama, for God's sake, ninth grade you had civics and 12th grade you had government. And it wasn't deemed to be a redundancy. And even as, you know, a little redneck kid, I remember learning about the forms of government, how a law was passed, you know, rudiments of governmental structure.
Right.
And I think a lot of it was de-emphasized or just, you know, lost.
Yeah, but I mean, when you say learning too, like when you say learning, when I hear education, I mean, unless you're talking about the extreme, you know, the college level and people kind of going out and innovating and all that stuff, starting stuff themselves. I think a lot of education is just emulation. It's just follow the leader. Yeah, you know, it's not necessarily learning so much as it is following.
Some of it is, I think some of it is regurgitation, and that's a failure of the system itself. Some, you know, there has to be some rote learning out there. Maybe a professional educator like Texas Betsy might disagree with me, but I really think there does have to be some rote learning. I mean, you learn, for instance, one of my favorite topics and subjects, you learn Latin by rote at first. You have to memorize how to decline a noun, how to conjugate a verb, and you have to learn sentence structure and syntax and grammar and word order and blah, 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 until you can begin to independently process information. And there's a lot of that stuff out there. Maybe I'm wrong, but you have to sit down and memorize the multiplication tables.
Right. Yeah, but here's the thing, though. I think that, and I don't want to interrupt you, but I think that learning, as far as like what you were talking about with the civics and the government, I mean, that's definitely important stuff, but what that should encourage is critical thinking.
Right. But some of critical thinking, John, is also wrapped up in reading complex language texts. For instance, what I was talking about with Dr. John about, you know, sitting down to read James Madison. It is taxing to say the least, because even the smartest people, there's just not a lot of people who write in a complexity of English that he did, because he was a freaking genius. In any age, any era, James Madison would be a genius. And it takes a lot of work to, but then you've got to, as Texas Betsy tells me via a chat message, she says many things need to be memorized, but then they have to be understood and placed in context. And it's that ability to contextualize things, to see, you know, to see echoes of one thing in another, to see echoes of the past in the reverberations of the future. That's where learning and thinking take place. I mean, we very seldom teach, for instance, we very seldom teach debate anymore in this country, when in fact the heart and soul of debate is learning how to form a logical argument that is cohesive and compelling.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, where do you think that comes from? It's like, you don't think that our elected leaders really want people thinking about what they're saying. I mean, you think Mitt Romney wants people actually analyzing what he's saying?
Well, I think that's the difference between a liberal or progressive versus a conservative philosophy. I mean, conservatives are, by virtue of their very nature, are more than happy to have people respond to an authoritarian mindset and do as they are told. And if along the way they want to spell poorly and conceptualize even worse, well, that's okay. But among progressive people, and to a certain extent, you can make the argument that, for instance, you know, Jefferson's idea of the enlightened agrarian, you know, farmer out there, I don't know, composing poetry in his head while he's you know, plowing his acreage, that's a progressive idea. That there is that there's more to humanity than to eat and excrete and die.
Well, yeah, but I mean that's also a very a somewhat Renaissancean outlook on life. And when you're right in that the the Republican sort of mindset is one of follow, obey, stick to the structure. Whereas the liberal one is more of like innovation, think outside the box, try to better things. But at the same time, it's like, I think that the mistake that's made between with Democrats is that we're so busy trying to be independent that we don't, at the times that we need to, focus on what needs to be collaborated on. In other words, we're so busy, it's kind of like, well, I don't remember who said the phrase, please tell me it wasn't a Republican, herding cats. But that's what it's like dealing with Democrats, because all Democrats all want to think for themselves.
Now, see, I'm not disagreeing to be disagreeable, John. I think it's a lot harder than that. You know, if you've got an open can of little Friskies, you can get a whole bunch of cats to come along behind you. No,
right.
when it comes to people on our side, and it's partly because of the mindset that we foster and want to have, and the individuality that we say we cherish, but it's also because we so thoroughly resist any authoritarian streaks. It's not herding cats; it's wrangling butterflies.
Right.
You can get some cats to come along, but getting more than one butterfly to do the same thing at the same time, it approaches the impossible.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is that, I mean, as far as what you were talking about with the appreciating independence, I mean, I think we appreciate everything to a certain level. You know, we appreciate capitalism as long as people who are successful don't actually have to pay for their mistakes. We appreciate being independent as long as it doesn't go too much against the mainstream. You know, we appreciate democracy as long as the ideas presented in the legislation don't challenge too abruptly what's going on. So, I mean, I just don't think that, I think that, you know, democracy is all, it's obviously great, but when you've got politicians that too often try to adhere to an old standard, then where does democracy, you know, begin and end? You know, democracy as opposed to...
Yeah, but see, even bringing up the word democracy is troublesome, John. Or at least it is to me.
Okay.
Because and I've opined on this before, I've gotten to where I go a little bit crazy whenever I hear a politician or an activist or anybody say these two words, our democracy. Because
right.
It's bullshit. I mean, I'm not downing the idea of democracy. The idea of democracy is noble. But to suggest that we've even got the remote resemblance to one is laughable. I mean, this country was born with the Constitution. This country was born with a concept inherent inside the founding document that said some human beings on this continent were 3/5 of a human being. Now, any foundational structure that begins with that predicate,
mm-hmm.
Well, there ain't no democracy.
yeah, that's definitely a glaring hypocrisy.
I mean, our so-called democracy was born with the idea that women didn't have the brain power to be able to vote. It was also born with the idea that if you weren't smart enough to own a certain amount of property, you, by God, had no business going to vote neither.
Right.
Professor Keith Lilly, who works with Dr. Bill O'Brien in the PRISM program, PRISM, says that when it comes time to talk about things like that, he'll look at his students and say, everybody stand up. He says, we're going to talk about voting, and we're going to talk about who the framers and founders thought should be voting. And he says, okay, all the people of color, sit down. People of color, sit down. All the women, sit down. Everybody who does not own 40 acres, sit down. And at that point, the entire classroom is sitting down, John. And he says, welcome to your democracy.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a smart way to do it, but how many people do you think do that? I mean, most people don't do that. If you, like, okay, here's the thing. Don't get too shocked by this. I'm sure you won't. And I don't mean that. I mean that literally. I'm definitely sure you won't get shocked by this. But like during World War II, we went over and we fought these people for basically, you know, of course they murdered millions of Jewish people. But before they did that, they stuck these little yellow stars in their chests. And they said, okay, here's a yellow star. You go here because you got a yellow star. All right, we sent black soldiers over there to do it. Okay? Somebody, this is not, you know, the war's over. We're like, oh, victory's great. Victory's wonderful. Come back to the United States. And then they tell the black people, hey, listen, here's basically the same yellow star, not literally, but metaphorically. You go over there.
Right.
So, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. Where on the one hand, you've got the ideal, and then on the other hand, you've got the reality.
And the reality is that this is not a democracy. And the reality is that this was not, this nation was not founded on some notion that human rights or human dignity mattered most. This country was founded on the notion that property matters the most.
Right.
To the exclusion of about anything else that could possibly be run contrary to that. Women's rights, Native American rights. Rights of persons of color, rights of anyone who wasn't obscenely wealthy. Remember, it was the 20th century, wasn't it, when we started directly electing senators? Because the people who founded this country said that something as august as the Senate that the hoi polloi could not be counted on to choose them, so they wanted the political bosses in the several states to do that by fiat.
Right.
It's sobering to contemplate, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. And it's just, and here's the thing, too. It's like if you look at the chronology of America and you look at how long we've existed versus how long we've existed with at least the presentation of trying to give everyone rights, it's like, what, that didn't even come in until, what, like the mid-60s? And America was founded in 1776.
Well, that's one of the fundamental fallacies that people engage in, that America was founded in 1776. It was not.
Okay.
That's merely the Declaration of Independence, and all that life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness stuff is in the Declaration of Independence. But the Declaration of Independence is not the law of this land. The law of this land is the Constitution, and that doesn't come along until 1787. So all the high-toned, high-minded language that Jefferson he got included in the Declaration. By God, most of that was gone with the Constitution, because the Constitution is not a document that is about democracy. The Constitution is a document that is about keeping democracy in check. The Constitutional Convention was called because democracy was breaking out all over the country at the time, and it had to be stopped because the rich people were about to wet themselves at the prospect that democracy might interfere with their ability to go on being rich.
Right. Yeah, but so you're saying it's 1786?
87.
We said? Okay, so 1787. So you had 1787 to 1960-something. Okay, all that time, it's like I'm not saying that immediately during the 60s and everyone had rights. Obviously, they didn't. You know, the feminist movement didn't come along until, well, like the, I don't even, what, the mid-70s or something?
Well, I mean, if you count the struggle for suffrage, then it's a struggle that begins in the late 1800s. And culminates with the vote being given to women in, what, 1919?
Yeah, it was around there. It was like 1918, 1919. But here's the thing, though. The fact that it took all that time for, you know, a very large majority of Americans to actually be acknowledged as people, you know, not just, you know, someone to go to the black section of the store, or someone who needed to mind her place in society because she was just a woman. I'm not saying that. I'm just reflecting the attitude of the time. I mean, the fact that it took all that time just to get that done, and what do you think that really says about progress and our national attitude? You know, I mean, it's like even at this point, we're still arguing over stuff that I guess people could call environmental rights. And I'm sure in 20 years we'll look back at that and say, you know, why are we even arguing over this?
Oh, I don't think that's the case at all, John. I think because I don't think corporations are going to change in 20 years.
Right.
It's like what Dr. John was saying about fracking. They frack because obtaining shale gas is their business. And if they have to poison a few wells or kill a few people, that's okay as long as it's still economically feasible.
Right. But how does that even fall into that's totally absurd to me, and obviously it's absurd to you, but how does that even fall into the national, you know, the environment? I mean, how is it that we as a country can get up and say, listen, if a few people die so some corporation can make some money, that's okay. You know, who says that? Why would anyone even allow that to be?
Who says it? It's said in every quarterly profit and loss statement of every major corporation in this country. You know, some of us are beginning to pay attention to things like, in my case, mountaintop removal, in the case of others, fracking, the Keystone XL pipeline, because some of those chickens are beginning to come home to roost. You know, how long have people been suffering profound human rights abuses in the rest of the world over the extraction of oil? But it didn't bother us then because it wasn't happening to us.
Right. Was that NIMBY?
To a certain extent, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so basically you're saying that people are kind of waking up to the environmental stuff?
No, they couldn't care less about environmental stuff, John. What they're waking up to is that they are being poisoned and killed. You're never going to, I don't want to disappoint anybody, but you're never going to win an argument generally in this country with a so-called environmental argument because it's too nebulous. It's too ethereal. Now, that's not to say that I don't love it, because I do. It's easy for me to care about the environment because I'm sympathetic. But the fact of the matter is, if you want Mr. and Mrs. America on their couch, you've got to show them what it's going to do to them. And they're not going to get worked up about the oldest mountains on Earth or mountains being blown up or somebody's water being ruined somewhere else. You have to show them that this has a direct relationship to them because people act based upon their so-called enlightened self-interests.
Right, and do you think, like, what do you think people would do? Like, let's just say hypothetically we get to the point where they can actually show people, hey, this is what's going on, here's how it's directly affecting you, it's not some sort of superficial thing that's happening in some other land. What do you think they would do? Like, what do you think? I mean, there's so many examples right now of things that actually affect people here in America. I mean, even if you just took Katrina, okay? Most people, I realize, okay, so it happened a few states away. Maybe that's still not personal enough. But just the same, okay, Katrina happened, and everyone was like, okay, well, why are people still sitting there on their rooftops waiting for stuff that should have arrived, you know, days ago? I mean, even if you look at what was it, this one last thing. The tornadoes over in Oklahoma, where people were like, all right, where's the help? Where's the help? And then politicians are like, oh, you gotta wait. You know, we gotta make appropriations first. I mean, even if you look at things like that, obvious outrages, obvious, like, what are people doing? People still don't, you know, get up and say, oh my gosh, you know, this doesn't make any sense. They're just like, well, I hope someone comes along soon enough. You know, so even like what you're referring to is people getting, taking action because they realize they're directly affected. But we've got examples of people being directly affected and not really taking any action at all.
Because it hasn't gotten close enough to home yet.
Well, I mean, the stuff in Oklahoma, I mean, who's that guy? Was it Coburn? Who was like, we need appropriations first. I can't help you guys. Wasn't that Coburn?
Yeah, I won't support storm relief until we've had budget good, until we've imposed misery on someone else somewhere else.
Right, so it was a guy in their own state, well, maybe not physically there, but from their own state saying, listen, I can't help you. You're standing in the middle of what used to be your house, and I still can't help you because I need appropriations. I mean, what? And they're not like, you know, he's still in office. I mean, I realize it takes time, but just the same, it's like, what? Who's getting outraged at Coburn right now?
Well, the rest of the, anybody who has a shred of common human dignity and decency is outraged at him. But here's the fun part. He can go on being an asshat like this because he's not going to run for re-election.
All right.
Oklahoma will find someone even more odious than him to send to the Senate.
Who's the guy that just, from Montana, the Democrat?
Baucus.
He wasn't really a Democrat. He was the, Max Baucus, yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, obviously the Republicans do it like a billion times more than the Democrats, in my opinion. But just the same, it's like, why is he even allowed to happen? It's like they're supposed to be representatives, so represent. You know, don't just stand around waiting for appropriations to help someone get out of their, you know, destroyed house.
Yeah, but the thing that maybe you're sort of blowing past as it sits there waving at you from the side of the road, John, is that when you're talking about these Republicans, you're talking about people who, it's not like they're bad at doing this. They're very good at doing what they're doing. They oppose the very idea of the United States of America. These are unreconstructed fifth-generation neo-Confederates, okay? Their goal is to take apart the United States of America and replace it with some sort of merciless free market wonderland. They wave the flag, but at the same time, that the government that's represented by that flag, they despise and they hope to destroy. It's kind of like that thing we talked about on Tuesday night where that goober at Confederate Memorial Day in Baltimore over the weekend said, well, they was Confederate soldiers, and they're just as American as anybody else, except for the fact that by virtue of putting on the Confederate uniform, they stopped being Americans. They renounced their citizenship completely.
Right.
You know, they had to take loyalty oaths to come back into the United States and have their citizenship granted to them. They weren't just as American as anybody else. They were actually anti-American.
Right. No, I mean, I do acknowledge that Republicans are basically inherently KKK stooges and that they don't really care about the whole what's in the Constitution to or the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
No, that's Declaration of Independence. You're talking about promote the general welfare.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And they don't care about it. They definitely don't do it. So I'm not going past that. I definitely get that. I just don't understand how people can be like, you know, because like you said, you know, once it directly impacts, how are they not outraged? And at the same time, always directly impacting. And yet, I mean, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm obviously not there, so I'm sure there are people who are like furious at him. But at the same time, it's like he's, I don't know. I understand your point. I get it.
But understand that no movement has ever had broad-based popular support at its outset. None of them. Like I said the other night, the American Revolution was not supported by even a third of the colonists. But they did it anyway.
Yeah, well.
I mean, you get the idea.
All right, so here's the thing, though, right? So the revolution happens. We're in a democracy. Everyone's supposed to be represented. Where do you think we go as a society, because it's obvious that, you know, in spite of all the efforts that corporations may pursue, Americans are not going to be, you know, they're not going to ignore the things that are happening, you know, infinitely. Eventually they're going to say, okay, this is obviously wrong. I mean, look at Elizabeth Warren. You know, she's a great example of a politician actually doing what a politician's supposed to do.
And yet at the same time, she gets some very basic elements wrong on two votes in the last week. things that should have been a no-brainer for a progressive.
Which ones are those?
The GMO labeling and the cuts to food stamps.
Are you serious? She voted against the GMO thing?
Let me double check here, but yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Let me look it up real quick. Andy went and did the homework. Let's see.
Wow, that sounds like that one time, what was it, like Al Franken a little bit ago, he voted against something, and I was like, okay, it's got to be.
This was an amendment by Senator Gillibrand that would have stricken the $4 billion cut in the food stamps program, okay? Okay, she voted in favor of that one. She got that one right. Was it the GMO one?
I just like the fact that she actually sat there at the, you know, you can look it up on YouTube. I mean, I know you've seen it. I'm just saying, I like the fact she sat.
And understand, we need to get this right, because this wouldn't have required food labeling. It would simply have allowed the several states to say, to pass their own
right.
food labeling laws, you know, states' rights.
That's what I was saying before, too, is that half the time these people, you know, I'm not saying.
Yeah, that's the one. It was the GMO bill, and Elizabeth Warren voted against it.
Wow. See, that's the thing, too. And you just pointed out, it's not even really a big thing. It's just, okay, this would allow something to happen eventually, maybe, and yet she still voted against it. Huh.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like the fact that she sat in the hearings and she spoke with the.
Well, this is not to say that I don't like her or something. I do. I have tremendous respect for her. But.
No, I'm not generalizing. I'm just. Yeah. I understand your point, though. I mean, I don't understand why she'd vote against that either.
Well, if enough people ask her, she'll tell us.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think her future, do you think she's going to last?
Yeah, I think she will.
As far as, like, her, do you think she'll have, you know, a few more terms?
Well, I mean, this is her first one. It's hard to predict, but... I think she is a progressive superstar right now, so she's not going to have any problems raising money, which is the signal critical key to being able to go on being a member of the U.S. government, money raising.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't even get me started on that whole Citizens United thing. That's ridiculous. Who were you talking to earlier about that? You were talking to someone earlier about that, and you guys were talking about it, and I'm like, it's like, what is that? Of course, a corporation is not a person, obviously. I don't care how many people are in a corporation, it's still not a person. You know, if a bunch of people get into a car, the car doesn't suddenly become a person because a bunch of people are in the car.
Nice.
It's still a car. You know, I don't understand that reasoning at all. I just don't. You know, there's so many examples of things that happen legislatively that you look at, you know, like, oh, why would anyone do that? Why would anyone even validate it? You know, where's that coming from, and how does it have any sort of standing? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, there's so many times.
Well, you know, if you have the perspective of looking backwards 500 years in history, often you can point to something and say, and that's where it fell apart. Now, they tottered and went on and on and on, but eventually that was, you know, that right there, that thing right there, that was the beginning of the end. And right. Who's to say that the Citizens United decision might be that? Or maybe looking back, it'll be Union Pacific versus Santa Clara. The first thing that sort of opened this door, unless you're listening to Dr. Bill and understand that in the Dartmouth College case and a couple of others, John Marshall was laying the groundwork for corporate personhood way back before anybody thinks that corporate personhood was an idea. Even, you know, even geniuses, you know, people on talk radio who are progressive geniuses haven't talked about John Marshall's impact on it.
Yeah, you're speaking. Who's John Marshall?
Second Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
All right, that's embarrassing. So I didn't. Okay, and he's not a current justice, right?
No. We're talking about the early 19th century.
Okay.
When he was making America safe for corporate behavior.
All right. Yeah, but here's the thing, though. I mean, that goes back to the Barbara Tuchman book. You know, you're talking about retrospective analysis. Most people don't do that. You know, most people don't look back and say, okay, this is to this as this is to this. You know, so they're not going to look back and look at John Marshall or...
Right, because we've got an educational system that says we've got to teach STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, because we've got to compete with India and China. So, you know, right, we don't have time for our own history. We don't have time for our own national story. We don't have time for perspective or context. We don't have time for anthropology, for sociology, for history, for political science. Because, you know, you can't make a really big load of money off that. But if you can get out, if you can get all the kids into science, technology, engineering, and mathematics classes, well, by Jesus, you can put those people to work making widgets for Apple. In a foreign country.
Right. Yeah. Now, and here's the thing, though. I mean, do you think that, like, that's the other thing. China and India have billions of people, you know, so even if we got our education up to their standards, do you think we'd still be able to compete in the long run?
Look, we're around, even New York City is a rounding error to a couple of mid-sized Chinese cities, okay? We have no sense of perspective with regard to China. Their middle class is God knows how many factors, how many times larger than ours.
Wow. Does it really dwarf us that much? I mean, I know we only have a few hundred million people, so I guess it must. Wow. I mean, now, here's the thing, though, because, all right, do you agree with this? Because I don't know if I've heard you talk about this. But do you think that the argument that basically what companies are doing is very gradually moving, trying to move their customer base over to China and India and kind of, you know, they're like, okay, America's got 300 million people. That's great. But if I can get billions of people, that's even better. Like, do you agree with that assessment?
Sure, that's just market economics. If you've got a viable middle class, and see, that's what it's predicated on. None of this will ever be predicated upon the relatively tiny number of people who wind up being fabulously wealthy. All of these theories are predicated upon the viability of a middle class. So China has a burgeoning middle class, India has a burgeoning middle class, and the United States has a crumbling middle class. Well, where are you going to go look for markets?
Right.
Just because it's one of my pet issues. Once upon a time, every town of any decent size had a men's and women's specialty shop. And by that, I mean that you could go there and get a suit of clothes, or a woman could go and get a dress and all the accoutrements that went with it. A man could buy a hat, a belt, a pair of braces, shoes, whatever. And when you walked in the door, they'd say, well, good morning, Mr. Jones. And they might even have a notebook with Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones's measurements in them. And things could be tailored to fit them. Well, those days are largely gone unless you're in the largest of American cities. When I was a boy, I grew up, there was a store in Florence, Alabama called Otto Speaks. And you walked in the door, and it didn't matter if you were a banker's son or a furnace foreman's son. They knew your name, and they treated you with respect because they wanted your custom. Those days are gone. Those stores are gone. And America now dresses in basically sackcloth and looks generally shabby as hell because we dress out of Wally World. Well, guess where the tailors are? Guess where the specialty stores are? Hint, not here.
No way. Right. Yeah, now, here's the thing. Do you think it started with Reagan? Do you think it started with the whole monopolization process with him?
No, frankly, I don't. I think this really goes downhill with George H.W. Bush. The China thing goes downhill with George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton.
You mean like NAFTA?
No, I mean signing on. It used to be that periodically the federal government would review China's human rights record and every few years would have to renew most favored nation trading status. Well, in the Bill Clinton administration, he signed off on a grant of permanent most favored nation trading status with China. And then the poop hit the fan.
I'm unfamiliar with what does that do, or what does that status do? Like, how does it enable China?
Well, it opens up the doors of trade. It opens up the ability to do permanent business. Remember, George H.W. Bush's brother Prescott was president of the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce. Their whole goal was to open up the Chinese markets because they thought it would be great for American business. And then they opened up the Chinese market and found out what was actually going to happen, or, you know, law of unintended consequences, maybe, I don't know. But that what happened was that China's economy ate ours. I mean, for Christ's sakes, and people probably think I'm a damn fool for going on about this because they were pretty brutal in the first place. But, you know, Smithfield Meats out of Smithfield, Virginia. The world's largest single processor of hogs.
Right. Yeah, they just
got bought for $5 billion by the Chinese because they can't feed their own people, and pork in China has a way of often being rat. So, again, just to reinforce that, all the things that go with those noxious, nasty pork processing plants, their capacity will have to at least be doubled, if not trebled, and all of the nastiness will be externalized onto little communities like Tar Heel, North Carolina, where there are already vast seas, they call them lagoons, of toxic, poisonous pork production waste.
Now, do you think they'll just gloss over it by saying, you know, oh, we're creating more jobs?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, why not? Yeah, but the Chinese are some job creators. Look here. Look at the prosperity.
Yeah. It's amazing. That's the other thing. The Republican PR machine, that's just, ooh, it's disgusting. It's horrifying. I don't even understand how they do half the stuff, you know. They'll just go on TV and say something like, oh, yeah, well, we got, you know, China's taking over, but look at all the jobs they're bringing. And they'll just say it with a smile and a grin and a handshake.
There you go. There you go. John, it's been a great conversation. I'm going to roll on here, try to get a few more folks on. Thank you very kindly. I hope we'll talk soon.
Definitely.
All right. Bye now.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see, Jeremy's been on hold. He's waiting, calling from Vermont. You there, Jeremy?
Hello?
Yeah, hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Bob. Well, I just wanted to get off this subject for a second. And I wanted to mention that I sent you an email a couple days ago. I sent one to Mike, too, about that guy you both had talked about in Minnesota a few weeks back, named Tom Emmert.
Yeah.
He's part of that radio show, I guess, Davis and Emmer.
Right.
And he announced yesterday officially that he is going to run for Michelle Bachmann's seat. And I just thought it'd be nice to refresh people about his thoughts of the Newtown children and the parents that lost the kids, and how he said that he would tell them all individually to go to hell if they asked him to help with the new legislation. So that's the kind of guy that wants them to replace Hersey, and it sounds like nobody's going to contest his run from his side. He has some prior experience, from my understanding, in the local state.
Yeah, what was he? I forget what it was he was, but, yeah, he was nasty.
Yeah, they're both jackasses. I've heard bits and clips from them occasionally because I listen to another show that's not political off that channel, and most of the people in there are just sewers, but him and his partner especially are just trash. So that's the kind of guy that wants to go in. It sounds like he probably has a good shot at taking that seat.
Oh, I hope not. Bachman came very close to being beaten. And this guy even makes her look sane.
And then that's what I was trying to get at when I sent you and Mike both that email about this guy's really out there. I mean, I've looked into him, and he makes her look sane with all the crazy things she says. At least she's not saying she'd tell parents to go to hell that lost her kids.
Yeah, he was a member of the Minnesota House of Representatives, so, yeah.
Yeah.
He lost in a run for the governor's office, so the people of Minnesota have rejected him before.
And what I find funny is there's a couple guys who come on that channel before the show I usually listen to, and one of them vehemently dislikes Michelle. Michelle. Vehemently dislikes Michelle. Even helped her with her campaign at one point. Dislikes her completely, but loves this guy.
So oh, Jesus.
I don't really understand that, because Michelle is insane in her own right for the crazy things she says. I mean, Mike gave a good example, I think, a couple nights back, where he not even the new Bob.
Well, this guy is a straight-up freak, because he's got a history. He's got a past. Among other things, he proposed a law in the Minnesota House that would have utterly banned abortion. He's also a nullificationist. He introduced a bill once that would have said that all federal laws had to be pre-cleared before they could be applied to Minnesota. He wants Christianity taught in public schools. I mean, this is one sick little vomit puddle.
Right, and that's why I want to try to get it out here a little bit, maybe to some people in other parts of the country to hear about this guy, in case they don't know who he really is. I mean, this, especially people that listen from Minnesota, I wish they'd take note of this asshole and think twice before they even consider voting for him over someone else.
Well, what I find interesting is that after Michelle stepped down, Jim Graves, who had planned to run against her, bailed out on the election. The Democrat bailed.
Well, I understand if he bailed because he heard this douchebag said he was going to get in, and it sounded like it'd be a landslide victory for this guy, because so many people love him from his time in their house, wherever he was in, even though he says horrendous things every day that kind of echo what Rush would say in his own way, but even worse in some ways. At least Rush picks on adults most of the time. These were kids. Well, these were both at this point, but you know what I mean. it just frustrates me to think that people like this try to usually can slide under the radar, and because they're technically a local radio station, even though Clear Channel has their iHeartRadio apps, you can pick up shows nationwide. People don't hear about these asses.
Well, it amazes me that I guess that district really must be certifiably insane.
You would think so, since Michelle stepping down for her investigation, even though it's not an investigation, and her husband wants to pray away the game, even though he looks like he'd use it himself. I don't understand people's motivation to vote in people like this over time and time and time again. I realize there's a Bible Belt out there to some degree, but come on. I mean, a guy who says that parents want more legislation to help not get another 20 kids slain when they are 15, they should all go to hell.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things that turns my stomach. When I heard that he was actually going to officially run yesterday, it ruined my day. It really did. A little small thing like that, but it just made me mad the rest of the night.
Well, you know, at least it's not a hell of a lot of comfort, Jeremy, but I take comfort in the fact that you've got a pretty damned fine-tuned sense of ethics and morality, because you're bothered by something that's happening 1,500 miles away from you.
Well, It's the same thing with mountaintop removal. I fight for it here. I mean, we'll not fight for it, but fight against it. And it, people always look at, just like some of the other callers call in, so people look at like, why do you care? Like people in California that call in, like, crazy people, and they'll say that, why do you care? It doesn't affect you. Fucking right, it does, though. It does. We all drink the same water, and I've said this before. The water we drink now, the dinosaurs peed in 16 million, 15, whatever million years ago. They use the same water. It's a finite source. It does not come back once you've destroyed it. Resources are finite. Air is finite. And once you've destroyed your water source, you're pretty much screwed. Because you can live without a lot of things. A lot of the amenities like cell phones, phone service, even electricity. You cannot live without water.
No, and they're just not making a shitload more of it.
Right, and when they got people back to the wall because they can't breathe, can't drink, and then they say, oh, we'll just supply you with a 16,000-gallon tanker every month for your family to use at no cost for X amount of years, and they try to make it sound like it all got better, like the gas plant story, all the stuff how they would truck in huge, like, obscene, almost like gas tankers of water to people's farms to supply them. Well, that contract wasn't forever. Those contracts were only for, like, 20, 30 years. And then the understanding was you supply your own water after.
Right. Yeah, then it's good luck.
I mean, we have similar things that have happened here in Vermont. There's a mountain maybe 20 miles from here where a family was contacted by Verizon. And Verizon said, hey, listen, you're in a great spot for us to broadcast our radio signals. Can we lease your mountain for 30 years? Family, yeah, sure. And they say, we'll pay this, we'll pay that. I think the family's pretty much set for 30 years. But they're right below a transmitter. So their kids are being raised underneath one. Their animals, it's a farm. And I can't imagine that living right underneath a radio transmitter of any kind is probably a great thing in terms of the radiation when people don't think about. So it may not get them now, but sooner or later, that radio radiation is going to cause havoc somewhere. In some line, whether it's in them, or their kids, or their grandkids, or just down the line genetically, someone's going to mess up from that amount of radiation.
Very likely. Very likely. And when they try to complain, right. Somebody will say, well, you can't prove it was that.
Right, and I don't say this because I know people in the past, I've known people and worked with them, that they would go design these transmitters, work around these transmitters, and they wear radiation badges.
Yeah. RF is powerful and potent, depending on the how you get in proximity to it.
And a certain amount, they'd have to walk away because it was a healthy dose they could take in a, not even in a day, but like in terms of what you could take in terms of a good while.
Right.
I mean, another small example, which people don't often think of, is I worked at the local airport here for a while, and DHL still in business, and loaded their planes. And I remember them telling stories about air traffic control guys would go out once in a while where the radar tower was, and the radar tower here in Burlington is relatively close to the ground, so when it spins around, it hits everything in its vicinity. And one day, someone was out there, I forget, something blew across the runway, he ran out, he grabbed a piece of paper right near the tower. And some guy came out, in one of the emergency vehicles, I said, boy, it's your lucky day. He said, what do you mean? He goes, if that tower had been on when you were right there, you'd been fried and probably have cancer in 3 days.
Jesus.
That much power coming out of those towers. He said, you damn sure were sterile. Instantly.
Man.
So, but more or less, my main thing is just this Emmer guy. He's really just like, yeah, it doesn't, it's not me personally, but in the end, it is me personally, because when change happens in one place, it affects everybody.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Well, Jeremy, it's awful good to hear from you this evening, and hopefully we will talk more and soon.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right. You take it easy. Have a good evening.
You too, Bob. Thanks.
Bye now. Our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. Got about 15 minutes left in the program, more or less. And before we get out of here, A, I want to thank everybody for helping out in the fundraising this evening. We've gone a long way toward where we needed to be. Let me see here. I just want to double check. Yeah, $230 have been raised this evening, and that's only $70 short of the at least $300 we needed to bring in just to keep things cooking for the evening. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Kath and Diane and Ed and Brian and Henry and Horst. Thank you. Thank you all. And by the way, thank you, Randy, for being the first one in for the new month of June. That was much appreciated. But it is what we have to, it is what we have to do in order to keep, keep things going. I think I got everybody. Thank you. And just a reminder, you may recall from time to time that when the Horns resident optimist Preston calls in from Denver, he will reference a publication called Yes Magazine. Well, they're still doing magnificent work, Yes Magazine is. And I want to draw your attention, please, to a couple of pieces by Jeff Biggers, our good, good friend, over the last couple of days. A couple of years ago, again, with Preston's help, Dr. Sandra Steingraber, who was the brilliant author of a magnificent book called Living Downstream, was on the program, and we had a magnificent conversation, wonderful conversation. She's one of those super smart people that really, really inspires me. And even though the Sierra Club had gotten in bed with the frackers in Illinois, she still stood up against them. And so on June the 4th, Jeff Biggers and Ben Evans authored a piece at Yes Magazine, which is yesmagazine.org, called Illinois Flawed Fracking Law is Everyone's Problem, Ecologist Says. And let's see, one, two, three, four. There are five separate video files there of Sandra Steingraber talking about what fracking means for a community and what that god-awful bill means for Illinois. While the program was going this evening, I received a new email from Jeff Biggers. And what a dynamic writer he is, and what a good human being. A new article has gone up at yesmagazine.org. I really do. Preston was the one who put me onto Yes Magazine, and I want to recommend them to you. They are very it's real journalism. They are non-profit. That they are not for profit. They're not filling out a quarterly profit and loss statement. They are not a member, therefore, of the for-profit media. They are utterly independent. And they get along kind of the same way that the Horn does, by subscription. The people who read them support them, just like the people who listen to the Horn also support the Horn and make the Horn possible for other people who can't help out but still want to participate. You want to read this June 6th article. I'm not kidding. Headline, Pro-Fracking Greens Called Out in Ecologists' New Manifesto. In a statement, ecologist Sandra Steingraber denounced Illinois' new fracking regulations and described the need for a movement dedicated to abolishing fracking nationwide. Yeah, while we're at it, we can do mountaintop removal. Because as Dr. John and I talked about earlier this evening, it is no more acceptable to poison you over there than it is to poison me over here. And I am a part of the whole. That's a concept maybe that maybe we have lost. Jeff Biggers does a very good job in this article setting the stage and all the context that enfolds the fracking issue in Illinois. With New York readying to rescind or keep in place that state's temporary moratorium and high-stakes battles taking place across the nation about whether to regulate fracking or place moratoriums on it, Steingraber and a network of citizen groups have viewed Illinois as the staging ground for a fracking rush that will have an extraordinary ripple effect. Once hailed by the Sierra Club as the new Rachel Carson, Steingraber denounced Illinois' bill as the result of closed-door negotiations between industry representatives and compromise-oriented environmental organizations. That's the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club sold out the people of Illinois. They sold them out. That may be hard to get your head around. That's the Sierra Club, you know, warm and fuzzy, protecting the environment. They sold out the people of Illinois who were demanding a moratorium and instead sat down and cuddled and snuggled up against the frackers and played footsie with them and backed this fracking bill because the Sierra Club, because they're smarter than the people on the ground, you know, the hoi polloi and the prairie protesters and the angry hillbillies. They're smarter than you are, declared there's a right way to frack. Go to yesmagazine.org. Read a fracking manifesto from Sandra Steingraber and the people of Illinois to the nation. Read it. I want to get back to the phones, else I would read it myself. I'm going to print it and pin it on the daggum walls, what I'm going to do. Let's go to the phones. Mark is calling from Florida. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. I've been listening to the show all night, and I'm just privileged to speak to you while you're in the nation's capital, and I appreciate your continued efforts to support a safer nation for all peoples and a safer world. I just was thinking as I listened to your show tonight about fracking, and then Dr. John calling in, and it just kind of struck me. Fracking is so widespread right now in the United States, and I think it will unfortunately continue to be that way, that I think, is it just me, Bob? I might be a little slow, but aren't they fracking more than they're obviously consuming? I don't see it all being consumed as quick as it's being fracked. And my theory just in my heart and my chest hits me is who's paying for all the fracking? Would it not be the Exxon Mobil, so they can replace their loss of oil revenues here domestically by increasing their oil spending or sales to the multinational to China and India?
Candidly, I don't know the economics of that question, Mark. But I mean, we know who the players are. You know, it's your Cabot Energy, it's your Chesapeake Energy. And they, in their own right, are a gang of filthy, toxic, poisoning thugs who, frankly, like Dr. John said, don't care who they poison, don't care whose water they ruin, because it's not part of their business plan.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the thing that bothers me more than anything, well, I despise fracking any way you slice it, but I tell you what, and I haven't said it this plainly, I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'm done with the Sierra Club. I'm just done. Anybody who gives the Sierra Club a goddamn dime is out of their minds. If they care about this planet and if they care about the human beings who live on it, they are out of their freaking minds, Mark. Because the Sierra Club sat down and negotiated away the rights of Illinois people because they thought they were smarter.
Well, I was listening to you, and it seems to me that, like so many entities, and the Sierra Club has not escaped it. They made more out of themselves than the actual reality. In other words, what we say in the Marine Corps is generals lose wars, privates fight the wars. So, you know, Sierra Club's leadership in other words, they've been corporatized, Bob.
Absolutely.
What about I haven't read Robert Redford, but it seems like he's kind of making making some stands lately. He's not a sellout to Sierra Club. He's still a real fighter, isn't he, Bob?
I don't honestly know. I don't know who is aligning which way. But let me tell you what Sandra Steingraber says here in this manifesto.
Okay.
No longer shall national environmental organizations based far from impacted realities make decisions that will have life-changing impacts on the people living in impacted zones. We will call out organizations that betray core values and integrity. We will openly inform their membership and their funders and reveal the truth of where they stand and at whose expense.
That's good language.
I think she may be ringing the bell for the Sierra Club. This is one of those for whom the bell toll moments.
Understand? Yeah, understand.
Because you know what,
Bob,
I've experienced it, Mark. I've experienced it. The Sierra Club comes in from God knows where, and they start trying to convince you that they know better than you know what you and your community needs. And if you say to them, but please, can you help us live on something besides beans in Washington, D.C. while we're working on the AIC Act, they'll say, no, we got no money for you, but we'll hire a lawyer to bring a lawsuit over selenium pollution that the coal company reported itself on itself. And so the lawyers will have a nice payday. But you dumbass hillbillies, you piss off, you know. That's what you get from them.
Well, Bob, any real warrior like your buddy Bo Webb and yourself know that the information is always in the trenches. And for any officer, any senior enlisted person to deny and to not pay attention to what the people in the trenches are saying are moving at their own loss. And then Robert McNamara, the bean counter for Vietnam, and their strategy of numbers, and not listening to people like David Hackworth or other folks that really knew how to start winning an actual war there in Vietnam if it was considered winnable. But in other words, you can never deny the experiences of the people that have the personal motivation and the real life world experiences to do that in war or combat. That's just a grunt. Is life-threatening immediately to yourself. So that's why I continue to listen, and leadership will always shift. And it's, whether it's the FBI, the Catholic Church, the Sierra Club, there's corporatization of all of it. The waves can consistently shift, but it takes decent, honest people who are not sold out to keep pushing, and you'll end up back with some real people again, which I believe it started out that way. But I don't know that much specifically about them, but it does seem, just listening to you, that any case, I can't deny people, because it's all of us. We're just glad and lucky to have someone like yourself, Bob, that is educated and has a heart and a family that loves him, that speaks for all Americans, starting with your own backyard, whether they listen to you or not. The nation is listening to you, and I'll just hang up, but I appreciate the work you continue to do, Bob.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You have a good evening.
Keep your chin up, Scott.
Thanks. Bye now.
Love you.
Mark's always an inspiration. So it's time to get out of here. Thank you. And, hey, thanks to Sal. All of you working together have pushed us to $330 this evening. It is awesome. And it makes bill paying a hell of a lot easier, I can tell you that. Thank you very much. Thank you. Time to get out of here. Rick Smith is next. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks. Thanks. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.